between their own personal feelings and their desire to uphold their duty to safeguard the surviving colonists. Indeed, he had already received reports to that effect, with officers remaining on duty even in the face of growing civil unrest and working to maintain order. How long could that last, given the startling news about Starfleet's imminent arrival and the growing awareness that the sacrifice was as pointless as it was severe?
"Order all watch commanders to remain on station until further notice," he said,
hoping it would not end up being a futile gesture. The officers on the ground only needed to hold out for another day at most until the Starfleet ship arrived.
All of this was preventable.
If only we had been left alone to live our lives in peace.
"Sir?" Galloway's query made Kodos realize he had spoken the words aloud. It also made him aware that with his arms crossed, he once more had taken up the unthinking habit of stroking his thin, well-trimmed beard. It had become something of a nervous affectation in recent days, and it was beginning to annoy him.
"My apologies, Ian. I was only thinking that none of this had to happen, if we'd just been allowed to chart our own course. Instead, one could argue that our predicament exists only due to Federation interference."
Another colony world, Epsilon Serona II, fell victim to a global catastrophe. Tectonic stresses far below the planet's surface subjected the 6,000 colonists there to earthquakes that only continued to increase in frequency and severity. With just enough time to evacuate the planet before the quakes devastated everything, colony support services were left with few options relocating so many people in such a short span. Federation officials decided Tarsus IV was the best candidate for relocation. Though the planet was more than suitable for sustaining the new arrivals, some members of the colony's leadership council voiced concerns over strains on available resources. Officials overseeing the emergency relocation pledged all manner of support to alleviate such issues, and even Kodos was forced to admit that both the Federation and Starfleet exceeded the most generous estimates when it came to the provided assistance. Still, there were those among the established colonists, Kodos included, who felt that their community's ability to weigh in on the choice was sidestepped, if not outright ignored. None of this was the fault of the relocated Epsilon Serona colonists, of course. Indeed, many of the people brought here ultimately chose to stay rather than be taken elsewhere once opportunity and resources presented themselves. They did their best to integrate with the existing population and respect the vision of the colony working toward being a completely independent society. Some even seemed accepting of the more hardline stance espoused by Kodos and others like him, who believed that everyone here should be educated, engaged, and productive citizens working toward a common goal of total autonomy. Now, all of that was in peril. If the refugees from Epsilon Serona II had simply been taken to another planet, any other planet, it was possible that what everyone had been forced to endure might never have happened. He would have been allowed to continue in his life as a simple scientist, immersing himself in Tarsus IV's geology and the untold stories it was waiting to tell, and spending the rest of his life learning whatever secrets the planet had managed to keep to itself before living beings chose to make it their home. Why had he stepped forward? As much as Kodos might wish to deny the truth even to himself, the reasons were simple. The situation called for leadership his predecessor, Governor Ribeiro, and her advisors were unable to provide. Unwilling to stand by and watch this leadership disaster, Kodos convinced a sufficient number of council members to vote for removing Ribeiro from office. Despite his bold move, and even with the support of his friends on the council, he assumed the governor's role with great reluctance. Galloway asked, "Do you regret the choices you made, sir?"
"No. And yes." Blowing out his breath, Kodos shook his head. "Upon reflection, I moved too quickly to make my ideas known. Governor Ribeiro and the others weren't able to consider the merits of my survival plan."
No sooner was he named governor than Kodos began communicating his initial thoughts on the colony's ability to weather the mounting crisis. He did not come out and say what he had in mind, but he did share his thoughts about how the community's weaker members, those who might not be able to contribute toward its preservation in the days and weeks to come, presented a liability. And even this mild point was met with resistance. Why could Ribeiro and her council not be more open to the harsh necessities that survival demanded? If they had, Kodos might not have been forced to implement such a drastic action so soon after assuming the mantle of leadership. Ignoring his initial temptation to include Ribeiro and the council as part of the sacrifice, Kodos instead ordered them placed into protective custody. Despite whatever differences in opinion or perspective they might have, the truth was that the former governor and the leadership council would be needed once the emergency was over and the colony turned its attention to moving forward from the tragedy that had been forced upon them. Of course, for all the help Starfleet and the Federation would provide, their assistance would also serve to undermine what Kodos felt compelled to do. Who, if anyone, might attempt seeing things from the perspective of those forced to live through this crisis? There was no way to know for certain, but Kodos did not find it likely. It was more probable that the off-world authorities and those who survived both the plague and the sacrifice would curse his name. Historians and other so-called experts, along with pundits and everyone else with an opinion, informed or otherwise, would be debating every aspect of this incident for years. A tone emanating from Galloway's tablet broke Kodos from his reverie, and he looked over to see the other man consulting the device, his expression turning to one of renewed concern. "Governor, there's been an update on the status of the Starfleet ship. I've just heard from the communications center that they received another message advising us that they'll be here within 2 hours." Kodos frowned.
"So soon?"
"You can't stay here, sir," said the younger man. "They'll arrest you at their first opportunity. The spaceport isn't an option, as the portmaster has been ordered by the Starfleet captain to block access to either of the two ships berthed there." The order, though prudent, was also superfluous. Once it became obvious that the colony was suffering from the equivalent of a viral outbreak, quarantine procedures were automatically put into effect to prevent any threat of contamination from leaving the planet. That meant the shutdown of the New Anchorage spaceport, and the portmaster had overseen the process of locking out access to the onboard systems of both cargo transports docked there. Neither vessel could attempt a launch without those computer lockouts being rescinded, which required authorization from the Starfleet or Federation representative tasked with answering the colony's distress call. By activating the quarantine protocol, the portmaster had removed herself from the equation.
"An efficient, if inconvenient, development."
"Alert the others," he said.
There was no need to elaborate further, as Galloway understood he meant the small group of loyal supporters who would be traveling with him.
"We've saved all we can, Ian. It's time to go."
Seven.
"Look out!"
The warning from Terry Bridges came at the same instant Lorca registered movement in his peripheral vision. He ducked, pushing the ensign to his right as the chunk of concrete sailed over his left shoulder and slammed into the building behind him. The piece of shrapnel bounced off the wall and dropped to the sidewalk, cracking into several smaller sections. Angered by the random attack, Lorca reached for the phaser concealed beneath his shirt. He stopped himself before drawing the weapon, focusing his attention on the group of four men less than 10 meters from where he and Bridges stood. The piece of debris had come from that direction, but none of the men seemed to be paying any specific attention to him or Bridges. Instead, they were using crude clubs to smash the glass from the windows of buildings and ground vehicles, beat on doors, and break lighting fixtures along with anything else that happened across their path. One of the men wielded a longer staff similar to those employed by martial artists. He sensed the men were not purposely attempting to harm anyone, but rather taking out their frustrations on whatever inanimate objects they encountered. In the 2 days that had passed since the summary executions, He had seen the gamut of emotions coursing through those few people they encountered in the streets. What began as simple disbelief and astonishment now was monopolized by feelings of anguish and swelling rage. For the moment, simple vandalism and other methods of disturbing the peace seemed to be enough, but Lorca knew it could not last.
Some of these people sooner or later will pose a genuine threat.
You okay? He asked Bridges, reaching out to rest a hand on her forearm. The junior officer, though noticeably shaken, nodded and offered a thumbs-up gesture.
Never better, sir.
Smiling at her ability to keep her wits about her, Lorca gestured for them to continue along their path.
We're almost there, he said, pointing ahead of them. The communications center is on the next street over.
After taking refuge in Belena Ferrasini's apartment on the night of the mass executions, Lorca and the others had done their best to maintain low profiles. Uncertain as to whether the security forces were still hunting them or if they were forgotten with all of the other issues plaguing New Anchorage, the Starfleet officers had taken advantage of the mounting confusion to secure a new hiding space. Governor Kodos and his people had even aided in that task through the simple act of publishing the names of those killed at the amphitheater. It had taken Lieutenant Soltani mere moments to cross-reference that list against the other occupants of Belena's building and find those occupants who would unfortunately never return home. At first uneasy about the unconventional tactic of seeking refuge in a dead person's home, Lorca knew such measures would be the only way to stay ahead of any potential pursuers until they formulated a better long-term strategy or the Starfleet ships arrived. It was while watching the news broadcasts from their new hideout that Lorca and the others first learned that someone assigned to the New Anchorage Government's Communications Center dispatched news of the Starfleet vessel's impending arrival. Far ahead of even the most optimistic estimates, the ship was due to arrive within hours. The news served only to heighten Lorca's grief and seething anger at the horror inflicted upon the colonists.
Belena.
Her face filled his mind as it had countless times during the past 2 days. Once more he forced the image back, wanting to lose himself in it and yet knowing that was impossible, at least for now. He still had two friends and subordinates looking to him for leadership. Until Starfleet arrived and got this situation under control, it was just him and his team doing whatever they could to find Kodos and perhaps glean some answers for the senseless tragedy inflicted on the people of Tarsus IV. The first item on his agenda was making contact with the approaching Starfleet ship. Comm systems at the outpost were still down, and without access to a transporter or ground vehicle, the facility was out of reach for the moment. That left the Colony Communications Center, even if getting there meant plowing through whoever stood in their way. Bridges asked,
"Do you think Soltani's all right, sir?"
"We'll know soon enough."
After leaving the apartment, the team had once more split up for the movement to the Communications Center, which was located adjacent to the offices of the governor and the rest of the colony government. Soltani departed first, following a route that would take him through this part of the city and toward the comm center from the east, while Lorca and Bridges approached from the west. The plan was to meet near the building's main entrance before surveying the scene and figuring out how best to gain entry. That it might mean putting a security officer or two out of commission was a possibility Lorca could accept. Once they were moving again, he saw ahead of them that the four rioters had crossed the street and now had something else on which to focus their interest, in the form of a single colony security officer.
Hang on.
Lorca looked around to see if anyone else was reacting to the developing situation. While there were other people visible on the street, no one seemed to be taking any notice of this group. Without saying anything more to Bridges, he stepped from the sidewalk and crossed to the street's opposite side, maneuvering into the shadows cast by the building as he approached the men. A quick glance to Bridges told him she was following his lead while making sure no one else was trying to move in behind them. Her hand was at the small of her back, where he knew she had secreted her phaser. It was his preference to avoid drawing their weapons and the attention they would attract, but that would depend on the men's intentions. As he closed the distance, he was better able to hear what they were saying.
"Here's one of them. Walking out here all by yourself? Bad idea, buddy."
"Were you there? Were you one of the people killing my friends?"
The voices were becoming louder and more belligerent in tone with each passing moment, and Lorca saw that two of the men were brandishing their clubs in what could only be an aggressive manner. Realizing he was about to be cornered, the security officer reached for the phaser at his waist, but one of his adversaries was faster. A fit-looking blonde in his late 30s or early 40s by Lorca's estimate, he did not present the appearance of a trained fighter, and his attack was clumsy but still sufficient to knock the officer's phaser from his hand. The weapon clattered to the sidewalk, and one of the men kicked it away. Holding his wounded hand, the officer uttered a grunt of pain that earned him derision from the four men. He was looking for a path to escape, but his assailants had spread out, forming a semicircle in front of the man, forcing him backward toward the building behind him. The one wielding the staff and the group's apparent leader, a gangly man with thinning dark hair and wearing what might be an engineer's coveralls and heavy boots, began waving the weapon toward the officer. The way he carried himself indicated he might be a greater threat, so Lorca adjusted his approach, deciding this man needed to be confronted first. There were easier ways to go about neutralizing this potential problem, of course, but the simple fact of the matter was that after 2 days spent hiding in empty apartments, alleys, and other dark corners of New Anchorage in the wake of what happened in the amphitheater, after what had happened to Belena and so many others, he was feeling mean. "Cover me," he said to Bridges.
"Commander."
Lorca heard the ensign's implied warning, but ignored it as he approached his chosen target and lunged forward with a fist to the right side of the other man's head. The single punch, though not enough to kill his would-be adversary, still dropped him to the sidewalk like a puppet with severed strings. He was unconscious on the way down, and Lorca caught the staff as it fell from the man's grasp. Spinning it in his hand to get a better grip, he turned to face the man's companions. Without shifting his gaze, he noted Bridges moving closer, her right hand held tight against her side. She had drawn her phaser and was ready to use it. None of the three remaining men had taken notice of her presence. With that in mind, Lorca moved to keep their attention on him.
"Four against one?"
He made a clucking sound of mock disapproval.
"That's not very sporting, is it?"
Rather than answer the taunt, the blonde man chose to step forward. He held his own makeshift club in both hands and attempted to assume what he likely thought to be some flavor of offensive pose. Lorca saw the attack coming, and with a single movement swung the low end of his own staff upward. Its tip caught the other man just under his chin, stopping him cold. Lunging closer, Lorca shifted the staff and brought it back the other way. Its opposite end whipped down across the man's face, eliciting both a scream of pain and a thin line of blood from his forehead down the left side of his nose. He staggered backward, tripping on the edge of the sidewalk while reaching for his face and falling into the street. Hitting his head on the hard ground, he released a muted grunt of pain before slipping into unconsciousness. The pair of strikes had taken less than 3 seconds, and were over before the man's remaining friends even realized what was happening. Lorca returned his staff to his two-handed grip, holding it before him. He ignored the look of warning from Bridges, who seemed ready to stun the remaining two men with her phaser, but she held her position, her expression and wide eyes asking Lorca for direction.
"You can either collect your friends and move on, or we keep going."
Despite his desire to bring a quick end to the confrontation, part of him was hoping his adversaries might choose the latter option. The first man, balding and slightly overweight, was wearing stained work clothes that reminded Lorca of a mechanic's uniform. He moved to pick up his fallen friend's club, while his partner, a wiry fellow with dark hair and sporting civilian clothes one might wear for camping or hunting, pulled a long knife from somewhere beneath his light gray jacket. Lorca saw that the man's trousers were tucked into black boots that rose to his shins, hinting at a military background. The way he held the knife, low and to one side while presenting his left forearm, suggested at least some training in hand-to-hand combat. Lorca was fine with that.
What the hell is wrong with you? Finish this.
As with Bridges, he ignored his own warning.
Who the hell do you think you are? Asked the knife wielder.
A concerned citizen.
The man was smarter than he appeared, waiting for his friend to try something. Lorca did not catch the ploy until the other man was advancing toward him and swinging his club. Deflecting the attack was easy enough, with Lorca using his own staff to push the other man to one side before kicking him in the shin. The man's leg crumpled beneath him, and he fell to one knee, close enough that Lorca had to scramble to his right to avoid tripping or losing his own balance. The man with the knife was moving. Light from a nearby street lamp reflected off something shiny, and Lorca saw the long blade slicing toward his abdomen. A frantic swipe with the staff blocked the other man's forearm, but his opponent pulled back the blade, dragging it down the length of Lorca's arm. Gritting his teeth in sudden pain, Lorca swung his staff with his other hand, an awkward strike that was still sufficient to make the knife wielder step back to avoid the hit. A high-pitched whine filled the air, and bright blue light chased away the darkness for a moment as Bridges opened up with her phaser. The beam washed over the man with the knife, and he collapsed to the street. Before his one remaining conscious companion could react, the ensign turned the weapon on him. Then, being thorough, she applied a stun beam to the two men who still lay on the street.
"Thank you," said Lorca.
Bridges gestured to his wounded arm.
"Are you all right, sir?"
Dropping his staff, Lorca gripped his arm where he had taken the knife cut. A quick inspection told him the wound was long but not deep, and had not hit a vein. The injury was superficial and easily treated.
"I'm fine. It's not quite a scratch, but close enough."
He used the sleeve of his shirt to dab at the thin line of blood oozing from the wound.
"I'll take care of it once we get where we're going."
He looked to where the security officer had moved to stand against the wall, still holding his hand where one of the assailants had struck him. The man's expression was one of relief, but also uncertainty as he beheld his saviors.
"You're from the Starfleet outpost, aren't you?"
Lorca ignored the question and instead gestured to the man's hand.
"How bad is that? Do you need medical attention?"
The man nodded.
"I think he broke a couple of fingers."
"We can help with that," said Bridges.
Stepping closer, Lorca eyed the man.
"What's your name?"
"Jacob Clancy."
Lorca replied,
"All right, Jacob Clancy. As you can see, walking the streets by yourself can be hazardous to your health."
His eyes narrowed.
"Were you at the amphitheater?"
Realizing the implicit question entwined with the words, Clancy's eyes widened in renewed fear.
"No! No, I wasn't. I was on street patrol. I swear I had no idea that was going to happen."
He paused, clearing his throat.
"I still can't believe it did happen."
"I know the feeling."
Lorca gestured again to the man's hand.
"As I said, we can help you, but we need your help."
8. Located on grounds adjacent to the colony's center of government, the communications center occupied a building separate from the bulk of the administration's offices and was accessible to the civilian population. At least it was prior to the governor's declaration of martial law. Lorca expected to find an armed presence guarding entrances to the building and was not disappointed. A short path leading from the sidewalk to a grassy courtyard ended at a stone archway marking the building's main entrance. Standing just inside that portico was a pair of security officers, a man and a woman, both wearing uniforms identical to Clancy's and with phasers on their belts. Lorca saw glowing energy strips lining the archway's underside and cast a knowing look at Bridges, who stood just behind him as they and Clancy huddled out of sight next to a building south of the entrance and used the darkness for concealment.
"I don't remember them using a force field before," said the ensign.
Still cradling his wounded hand, Clancy replied,
"It's been there all along, but we never had a need to use it."
The security officer shook his head.
"This entire situation is I'm just doing what I can to keep it from going to hell. Keep any more people from getting hurt, you know?
I know.
Lorca gestured to the entrance. Do you have access?
Yeah, we all do.
Good. You're our ticket inside.
Clancy cast him a skeptical look.
They won't let you in.
Sure they will. We were attacked on the street, and you came to our aid.
Lorca held up his bloodied left arm. I need medical attention, and this is closer than the hospital.
His expression communicating his uncertainty in the impromptu plan, Clancy offered a nervous nod.
Okay. Commander.
Lorca felt Bridges' hand on his arm, then saw she was looking at something on the far side of the street. He turned to look in that direction and saw a lone figure moving up the sidewalk at a brisk pace toward the entrance and the guards. Even before the new arrival passed under a street lamp, he recognized Asal Sotani. As per Lorca's plan, the lieutenant had made his way from the apartment, but he seemed uninterested in joining his comrades. Instead, he appeared focused on the comm center entrance and the guards.
"What's he doing?"
asked Bridges.
Lorca had no clue. That seemed as good a reason as any to act.
"Let's go."
Advising Clancy to stick to their ad hoc scheme, Lorca indicated for the security officer to lead them toward the entrance. The trio was halfway across the street when Sultani arrived at the archway, and Lorca could hear the hum of the active force field.
"Officer,"
Sultani said, waving his hand to get the guard's attention.
"I need your help."
Stepping forward, the male guard, a man of perhaps 40 years with gray-black hair cut in a severe military style, eyed the lieutenant with obvious suspicion.
"What's the matter?"
"It's them,"
replied Sultani, then surprised Lorca by pointing at him.
"They've been following us and threatening us."
"I'll be damned."
Lorca forced himself not to smile at the lieutenant's quick read of the situation and improvisational skills.
"Nice job, Asal."
Adopting a hard expression, he continued his advance toward the entrance. Behind the force field, it was evident the guards were confused by what was playing out before them. The female officer, a trim human with red hair pulled back into a ponytail, noticed Clancy's uniform, but to Lorca did not appear to recognize him. Adapting to the evolving deception, Sultani said,
"He tried to arrest me! It's not past curfew, and I did nothing wrong!"
Lorca and Bridges stopped moving closer to the guards. Even Clancy, now up to speed on the ruse, halted his advance as, inside the archway, both guards drew their weapons. Looking up and down the street, Lorca saw that no one else was outside, or at least in this immediate vicinity. If they were going to do something here, it would have to be fast.
"Everybody just stay calm for a minute," said the female guard.
She nodded to Sultani.
"Please step back from the entrance."
Then the male guard granted Lorca's wish and dropped the force field. To his surprise, it was Bridges who took immediate advantage of the situation. Her movements partially blocked by Lorca and Clancy, the ensign was able to draw her phaser. She fired between the two men, her shot striking the male guard in the chest. Already unconscious, he was staggering backward as his partner reacted to the unexpected attack. She started to duck behind the archway, but Bridges was faster, her second shot catching the other woman in the side and sending her stumbling into the courtyard. Eyeing the ensign with amusement, Lorca stifled a chuckle.
"I think you're beginning to like that thing a bit too much."
Bridges replied,
"I was just aiming to avoid an argument, sir."
"Nice aim."
To Sultani, Lorca said,
"And well played, Lieutenant. How did you know we were here?"
He had not seen Sultani until they were almost at the archway.
"I played a hunch,"
replied the lieutenant, his expression wistful. After relieving the stunned guards of their weapons, Lorca and the others stashed the unconscious pair out of sight behind a row of hedges along the courtyard's near wall. With the force field reactivated, he led his team and Jacob Clancy into the comm center, with a security officer guiding them through the building's two-story interior. At this hour, there were few people working, but Clancy's knowledge of the center allowed them to avoid encounters with any on-duty personnel until they arrived at the main communications broadcast hub on the second floor. The oversized chamber with high walls was a rectangle, consisting of workstations lining the longer sides, as well as the far wall. Several view screens were set into the walls above the workstations. Though none of the controls were immediately familiar to him, they reminded Lorca of consoles one might find crammed into a spaceship's bridge or engineering room.
"Where is everybody?" he asked.
Clancy replied, "After 1900 hours, the center shifts to a minimal staff. There's a watch commander on duty, but they'll be in an office on the first floor. If anything requires their attention in here, an alert is sent to the computer terminal there." Turning at Soltani's approach, Lorca saw that the computer specialist had retrieved an emergency medical kit from a supply locker tucked into a corner of the room. He extracted an emergency field dressing and offered it to Lorca.
"You can clean and bandage your cuts, sir. At least until I figure out how to use the dermal regenerator."
"Thanks, Asal."
Lorca took the bandage and began rolling up his bloodied left sleeve while Soltani gestured with the kit to Clancy.
"I can treat your injuries, too."
The security officer nodded in relief and gratitude before he and Soltani moved to a small circular conference room just off the hub's main floor. Soltani set to work with the medical diagnostic scanner he found in the kit. As they were still close enough to converse, Lorca said,
"I'm surprised there isn't a greater security presence, given the increase in unrest and violence outside."
As he spoke, he opened a packet containing a disinfectant pad and used it to dab at the cut on his forearm. The cut had clotted a while ago, and the moist pad made short work of the dried blood along the wound's length.
"Force fields are active at all points of entry on all colony government and administration buildings," replied Clancy.
His right hand lay atop the table as Soltani ran the scanner over it. Then the lieutenant pulled another device from the medical kit and held it over the wounded hand.
"I apologize if this hurts a bit," said Soltani. "It's a bone knitter. Your fingers will be as good as new in a minute."
After Lorca finished sizing and applying the field dressing to cover his cut, he stepped away from the conference area and back onto the hub's main floor. Rolling up his right sleeve so that it matched its counterpart, he eyed Bridges and Soltani.
"I'd rather not spend a lot of time here."
He was worried about random inspections of the area by the watch commander or someone else just wandering around who might find them in the comm center or the two stunned officers out in the courtyard.
"We need to make contact with the incoming Starfleet ship. Can either or both of you figure out how to work any of this equipment?"
Soltani dropped into a chair situated before a nearby console as Bridges moved to an adjacent station. After a moment, the lieutenant said,
"This is all fairly standard, Commander. All of their systems are up and running, and we can make use of the communications array to transmit off-world."
Sitting to Soltani's left, Bridges added,
"I've got access to the network of sensor buoys deployed within the Tarsus system, sir. The incoming ship is the USS Narbonne, a colony support vessel. According to long-range scans, it should be here within 2 hours.
"Open a hailing frequency," Lorca ordered, feeling a small sense of relief beginning to build within him.
Even the thought of being able to speak to someone else about their current plight, knowing that help was on the way, made him feel just a bit better. A moment later, Bridges said,
"Frequency open, sir."
Stepping closer to her console, Lorca leaned toward the console's audio pickup.
"USS Narbonne, this is Lieutenant Commander Gabriel Lorca, commanding officer of the Starfleet Observation Outpost on Tarsus IV. Please acknowledge this transmission."
It took only a moment before Bridges reported the hail had been received and answered. She tapped a control, and one of the console's screens flared to life. Its image was what Lorca guessed to be a middle-aged human male of Indian descent with short, salt-white hair and dark, piercing eyes.
"This is Captain Aurobindo Koropati of the Narbonne. It's good to hear from you, Commander. We are coming loaded to the rafters, but we were fearing the worst for a while, when we got no response to our hails. The information I have on your present situation is a few days old, so hopefully you can fill me in."
Lorca exchanged looks first with Bridges and Soltani, then with Jacob Clancy, who had rejoined the group now that his hand appeared to have been healed.
I assume you already have the initial report sent to Starbase 11, sir. However, there's been an incident here that will require immediate attention upon your arrival.
Where's Governor Ribeiro?
Koropati's voice was level and composed, the mark of a confident, experienced leader. Lorca neither knew him nor was familiar with him, but guessed the captain and his ship and crew were assigned to this mission because they were best suited to handle things like natural disaster or disease or some other calamity that might befall a colony. On the other hand, maybe once the distress call was received, only the Narbonne was available to journey with haste to Tarsus IV. Lorca doubted Captain Koropati and his people were ready for what they were about to face.
I honestly can't tell you Governor Ribeiro's location, sir. She and her staff are no longer in any position of authority here. The governor was removed from her post and replaced by another individual, Adrian Kodos. He's a colonist, but as far as I know, wasn't in any leadership role here until 3 days ago. After declaring martial law, he...
The words caught in his throat, refusing to be spoken aloud.
"What is it, son?" prompted Koropati.
"What happened?"
"Some new viral outbreak that's affected the colonists. Does the planet need to be quarantined?"
Lorca shook his head.
"No, sir, it's not like that. We just need you, Captain. Right now."
Unable to look Koropati in the eye, he let his gaze fall to the floor. The captain was waiting for the rest of his report, but grief and fury were threatening a comeback, and he knew he needed time to process his shifting emotional state. The past 2 days seemed to him like months or even years had passed, draining him of strength or even the desire to keep moving. He did not want to go anywhere or do anything, not without Belena. Drawing a long, deep breath, Lorca willed himself to return his attention to Koropati. Help was coming far earlier than anticipated. For too many people, help was far too late. 9. Despite herself and even the assistance of the ship's internal environmental systems, Philippa Georgiou still felt the queasiness knotting her gut. With nothing to do but watch the activities of the Narbonne's bridge complement, her imagination could run wild as it conjured all manner of disastrous endings for what the ship was doing.
"Initiate landing sequence," ordered Commander Natalie Larson, the ship's first officer, from where she sat at the bridge's environmental systems station along the starboard bulkhead. A blonde human who looked to be Georgiou's equal in age, Larson had positioned herself at the workstation so that she could watch her instruments as well as the main view screen and other members of the bridge crew assisting with the landing operation. As second in command, Larson did not have a dedicated seat on the already cramped bridge. Instead, Georgiou noted that she tended to divide her duties between that of executive officer and different bridge stations based on current need. Lieutenant Melissa Parham, seated at the helm console at the bridge's center, replied,
"Sequence initiated. Warp drive is offline. Increasing power to inertial damping systems."
"Continue landing procedures," said Larson.
The helm officer reported,
"Placing atmospheric thrusters on standby."
A young human woman, Parham handled the ship's controls with the easy self-assurance of a skilled pilot. Her reports to Captain Koropati, sitting in the command chair behind her, and the rest of the bridge crew were crisp and precise, with no wasted words or time. She was also the only one, for example, who did not react when the Narbonne began descending through the atmosphere and was buffeted by the thickening, superheated air surrounding the transport. Whereas Georgiou's attention and that of everyone else was drawn to the onrushing clouds and bright morning sky, all distorted by waves of heat roiling across the ship's hull, Parham's focus was on the controls beneath her fingertips.
"Engaging atmospheric thrusters. Inertial dampers at maximum."
She turned from her station and glanced not to Koropati or Larson, but instead to Georgiou.
"This could get a little bumpy, Commander."
It took Georgiou a moment to understand what Parham meant, then she realized she was the only person on the bridge not occupying a seat.
Nodding in acknowledgement, she moved to the vacant engineering monitoring station at the rear of the bridge and took the chair. She noted Koropati swiveling his chair to look at her. The captain offered a small, sympathetic smile.
First time on a ship that doesn't stay in orbit?
Giorgio nodded, unable to hold back a small chuckle.
Yes, sir. I've been on shuttles and smaller transports that made landings, of course, but nothing this big.
Relax. Even seasoned planet hoppers get a little queasy on occasion. Don't worry, though. Param is one of the best there is at this sort of thing. She can do it with her eyes closed.
I'd prefer she didn't.
Given the circumstances and what they were about to face head-on, no one seemed moved to laugh at her attempt at humor, though Koropati offered another look of understanding before turning back to face forward. All around them, the buffeting became more pronounced as the Narbonne descended through the atmosphere, its engines battling the planet's gravity for supremacy. Within moments, the maneuvering thrusters gained the upper hand, and the shuddering subsided.
"Extending landing struts," reported Parham.
After another 90 seconds passed, Giorgio felt the slightest tremor as the ship's set of 8 squat landing struts made contact with the ground. The helm officer's touch was so soft that the touchdown was all but imperceptible. Parham glanced toward Koropati.
"Struts down and locked, sir. Commencing post-landing shutdown procedures."
"Deactivating artificial gravity," added Larson, tapping controls on her own console.
"Maintain atmospheric integrity," ordered the captain.
It was a point of discussion between him and Giorgio prior to landing that the ship would continue to observe standard ingress and egress procedures as though still in space. Until the viral contamination currently plaguing the colony could be isolated and dealt with, no chances would be taken with contaminating the Narbonne's own vast food stores. Rising from his chair, Koropati turned to the officer on duty at the communication station, Ensign Richard Doherty.
"Send a message to the colony leadership. Notify them we're here and commencing post-landing operations, and that I'll make myself available to whoever's in charge over there as soon as possible."
He turned his attention back to Parham.
"Lieutenant, let's have a look around. Put new anchorage up on the viewer."
"Aye, sir."
The helm officer tapped a control on her console, and the image on the view screen changed to offer a look at the main city as though seen from someone standing atop the Narbonne's hull. Giorgio knew from her review of the colony and its infrastructure that the main spaceport that was their present location occupied a broad expanse of relatively flat terrain 4 kilometers south of the main city, New Anchorage. A sensor scan prior to their landing revealed only 2 small cargo transports occupying berth space at the port, though neither vessel had its engine activated. There also was a single shuttlecraft attached to the Starfleet observation outpost. Scans showed that the tiny craft was powered down and resting on its landing pad near the outpost. After arriving in orbit hours earlier, Captain Koropati's first order was to the portmaster, forbidding access to the 2 transports and declaring that no launches or landings would be made without his personal authorization until further notice. As for taking his own ship down, he made the decision to wait for daybreak before attempting a landing and use the intervening time to conduct sensor sweeps of the entire area. Only then did the Narbonne's crew get its first confirmation of the horrific story relayed to them by Lieutenant Commander Gabriel Lorca. According to the scans, the population of Tarsus IV had been reduced by half, and sensors were able to detect residual indications of concentrated energy weapons use in New Anchorage's main amphitheater. Giorgio pushed herself from the chair at the engineering station and turned at the sound of the hatch behind her sliding open to admit the ship's chief medical officer, Sergei Varazdinsky.
"You asked for a preliminary report as soon as possible, Captain," he said by way of introduction.
His voice was thick with a Russian accent, which Giorgio knew from her review of his personnel file, came from his having been born and raised in the Bulgarian region on Earth. Koropati's eyes widened.
"Already? That's fast work, Doctor."
"I was anxious to see the results for myself."
As soon as the words left his mouth, Varazdinsky paused, frowning.
"Perhaps anxious isn't the right word.
A short, balding man of indeterminate age, he wore a rumpled physician's lab coat over his Starfleet uniform, and his hands were jammed into its pockets. Georgiou noticed his uniform was missing its top, as Varazdinsky tended to shun it in favor of a regulation dark undershirt. Like the lab coat, the shirt also lacked rank or department insignia. His round face sported several days' worth of beard growth, and his hair, like the coat and trousers, was unkempt. Even though he held the rank of lieutenant commander, it appeared as though he was doing everything in his power to prevent drawing attention to his status as an actual commissioned Starfleet officer. Having met the doctor shortly after coming aboard the Narbonne, Georgiou came to realize that Varazdinsky was in reality a civilian down to the subatomic level, who, for reasons surpassing understanding, had wandered into a Starfleet recruiting office before stumbling his way through the academy. From Captain Koropati, she knew the doctor had already completed his medical training and certifications prior to joining Starfleet. This begged the natural question of why a man of his accomplishments would choose such a career path, but even Koropati lacked an answer to that question. Further, from her own dealings with Varazdinsky and what she had learned from other members of the crew, she guessed that it was a topic he was not interested in discussing.
"What did you find?" asked Koropati.
The doctor's expression, which already seemed to have a default setting of annoyed, turned even darker.
"We ran biosensor sweeps of the amphitheater and picked up massive traces of disrupted and deconstructed biomatter, along with residue from synthetic materials that are likely clothing and things of that nature. It's as Commander Lorca reported. A large number of humanoid life forms in that contained space were subjected to an intense barrage of concentrated energy weapons fire. They were disintegrated en masse."
"No," said Larson, who had moved to stand next to Koropati. 4,000 people. For Georgiou, trying to process the magnitude of Varazdinsky's report was proving difficult. Present on the bridge when Commander Lorca's hail was received from Tarsis IV, she and everyone else was aghast at what they were hearing. Having the unbelievable story corroborated by the ship's CMO was like twisting a knife after being stabbed.
"This is unbelievable," said Koropati.
It was not the first time the captain had made the statement, but it was no less true for being repeated. Turning to Ensign Doherty, he asked,
"Have you gotten a response from the colony?"
"Yes, sir," replied the communications officer. "I'm in contact with Governor Ribeiro's aide. Apparently she's been allowed to resume her office."
Larson said, "I bet there's an interesting story behind that." Ignoring the first officer, Koropati asked,
"Where the hell is Kodos?"
Doherty replied,
"She doesn't know, sir. He seems to have disappeared along with a number of other people."
"Supporters?" asked Georgiou. "Others who helped him?" It dawned on her that Kodos could not have done all of this without help. How had she not considered that before now? Of course he had followers, people who either believed in what he was doing or were somehow forced to do his bidding out of fear for their own well-being.
"Who the hell is this maniac?"
"We'll find them, sir," offered Larson. "He can't hide forever, not from censors."
Koropati held up a hand.
"One thing at a time."
To Doherty, he said,
"Is Ribeiro available?"
"Yes, sir. She and her staff are waiting to meet with you at your convenience."
From the helm console, Parham said,
"Captain, there are several hundred people gathering near the spaceport's main entrance. They obviously knew we were coming, and there's no doubt our landing attracted attention."
"Are the entrances secure?" asked Larson.
Parham nodded.
"Scans show all 5 gates are locked and can only be opened with passcodes from port personnel."
"Tell the portmaster I want those entries to remain locked down until I say otherwise," said Koropati. "As for the governor, let her know we will meet in her office."
He gestured toward the viewscreen.
"Tell her about the people gathering. There may be an opportunity to address the public and perhaps ease some anxiety. A reassuring word certainly can't hurt."
Snapping his fingers, he added,
"What about Commander Lorca and his people?
Have they contacted us yet?
No, sir, said Doherty. I'm monitoring all frequencies, but so far they haven't reached out to us.
According to Lorca's report, he and the surviving members of his outpost staff believed their lives might be in danger following an attack on their facility by agents possibly acting on behalf of Kodos. Given the possibility of Kodos loyalists within the security forces' rank and file, Lorca felt it prudent to avoid any official colony government facility until personnel could be vetted. The commander's last report indicated he and his team would make their way to the Narbonne in due course.
They've been on the lam pretty much since this whole thing started, said Georgiou. They'll be thrilled with the break.
She knew from Lorca's report that the outpost's team were on the run, avoiding all unnecessary contact with members of the colony's security forces. The commander and his team would be grateful for the respite, rather than being forced to make do in the city while at the mercy of whatever emergency supplies could be found. After watching the bridge crew turn to various tasks for a moment, Georgiou looked to Koropati.
I can at least get my team started with whatever preliminary work needs to be done before we start deploying people, sir.
She would not know who was needed where until she got an updated report from the governor or whomever she appointed as liaison to the Starfleet personnel. Even without that information, she could make educated guesses.
According to Commander Lorca's report, there was a lot of civil unrest. Help will likely be needed at the hospital and wherever else they're treating any injured.
Koropati nodded in approval.
Sensors didn't pick up any fluctuations in the colony utility services, but let's stick to our plan anyway. Make sure the infrastructure is secure.
The planning discussions hashed out by the captain and commanders Larson and Georgiou had established a priority for the Narbonne's relief teams once the ship landed. A team of engineers would be sent to the main power distribution center to ensure the facility was operational and not in danger of being invaded by angry colonists. Similar inspections were laid out for water and sewage systems, as well as computer access and other services. Commander Lorca's report had not mentioned damage to any of these areas, but neither the captain nor Georgiou wanted to take chances.
Koropati said, "Naturally, the first priority is the colony's food processing facilities, farms, greenhouses, and any other places where food can grow on this planet. It's critical that absolutely everything be inspected. We want the contagion identified and isolated, or destroyed, before we break out any of the supplies we brought with us."
His expression fell.
"We apparently have more time to work until the existing food supplies are exhausted."
The captain's words gave voice to feelings harbored by Georgiou and everyone else aboard the Narbonne. Assembling in such short order a team capable of providing all manner of aid to the Tarsus IV colonists was no easy feat, but she and the people pulled together by Admiral Anderson were ready to answer the call. They were motivated by a desire to help others. Georgiou and the group of specialists, many of whom she barely knew, were set to hit the ground running in order to offer that assistance and hopefully alleviate even a bit of the fear and uncertainty gripping the stricken population. To discover that fully half of the people they were sent to help were gone, removed from existence with a single hellish command, was a gut punch. Everyone on the ship was still reacting to the news, and while that was not sufficient to sway them from their mission, the apparent mass execution cast a pall over the relief mission before it even got underway. Straightening his posture, Koropati said,
"Commander Larson, I'm going to prepare for our meeting with Governor Ribeiro. You have the con. Feel free to start a sensor sweep of the entire area, because I want to know where every living person on this planet is right now. Doctor, you're with me."
He turned his gaze to Georgiou.
"All right, Commander. You're up. Let's see what we can do to help these people."
"Aye, sir."
Following Koropati and Varazhdinsky through the hatch leading from the bridge, Georgiou found herself still struggling to find her bearing. How could something like this happen in this day and age, when technology had solved nearly every problem that plagued humanity before its discovery of faster-than-light travel and other inhabited worlds? It was a sudden, brutal slap across the face, a grim reminder that complacency and over-reliance on technology were fraught with risk, and that was before someone decided to introduce other elements into the mix. And what of Kodos, the apparent arbiter of this horrific act? The reasons that drove him to sacrifice 50% of the colony in a bid to extend the survivability of the remaining half were suspect. Surely other options were available that might have sustained the colony until help arrived. The threat of starvation, while real, was also not as dire as one might think at first. Children, the elderly, and the infirm would have been at greatest risk, of course, but even then there were means of addressing the immediate issue. That left Kodos, his motives, and his judgment.
Stay on target, Commander.
Coming to grips with the situation they were entering needed to happen quickly if she was to function efficiently during this mission. Georgiou knew there would be time for reflection and even grieving for the loss of the 4,000 colonists, but it would have to be later. Likewise, the search for Kodos, his followers, and answers would also have to wait, likely for people better qualified for such pursuits. For now, she had a job to do. Ten.
I know that many of you are scared. I know that many of you are angry. You want answers. You want closure, and you want justice. We will seek all of those things together. We will not rest until those responsible for the unspeakable tragedy we've suffered are made to answer for what they've done, not just for ourselves, but also for those who are no longer with us. We owe them that much. For their sake, we must rededicate ourselves to the continuing betterment of our community, and do so in living, eternal memory of those we lost. Thank you.
Georgiou watched as an aide standing before the transmission pickup signaled to Governor Gisela Ribeiro that the frequency was closed following the conclusion of her speech. Along with Captain Coropati, Georgiou stood in one corner of the room from which this and other speeches were broadcast, be they from the governor or other public officials. The centerpiece of the room was a raised dais upon which stood a podium bearing the governor's seal and a representation of the new Anchorage flag. Ribeiro stepped from behind the podium and moved to the edge of the dais, casting a look to the small gaggle of assistants and other members of her staff. She was a human woman of Brazilian descent, and Georgiou guessed her age to be mid to late 40s, while suspecting the events of the past few days would serve to make her feel even older and careworn. Despite help from a makeup assistant and vitamin and nutrition supplements provided by her personal physician, as well as a light gray women's pantsuit tailored to fit her trim frame, Ribeiro looked tired. That much was understandable, given that she and members of the colony's leadership council had been incarcerated by Kodos soon after he succeeded her as governor. Neither Ribeiro nor any of the other hostages were worse for wear after their brief ordeal, and she in fact had refused to discuss the subject. In her mind, 2 days locked in a jail cell was nothing compared to what the colony had endured. Following Captain Coropati's lead, Georgiou and Varazdinsky moved to stand with Ribeiro at the front of the platform.
"Thank you for staying," said Ribeiro.
She reached up to wipe a lock of curly brown hair from her eyes. Her voice was almost lyrical, thanks to what Georgiou recognized as a Portuguese accent.
"I just wish I could have given the speech to an actual audience."
"Not a good idea, Governor," said Coropati. "At least not until we are sure the situation is secure. After all, it remains to be seen how your return to office will be greeted by the rest of the colony."
Ribeiro replied,
"I appreciate your concern for my safety, Captain, but it's the least of my worries just now. We can't pretend this tragedy didn't happen, but we also can't allow ourselves to wallow in our grief. The people we lost deserve more than that. We will remember, but we will also proceed forward, as we always have."
During their first meeting in Ribeiro's office, the governor had expressed a desire to deliver her speech outside the amphitheater, hoping to reconnect with citizens as they each confronted their shared pain. Coropati pushed back on that idea,
worried that being so close to the place where loved ones were lost might provoke extreme responses from someone in any gathering. There was also the visceral reality of what had taken place in the stadium. As the executions were performed with particle beam weapons, there were no bodies requiring attention, but there would